Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Judges chapter 15. We are in the middle of the story of Samson, the famous story of Samson. In this chapter, we will see Samson defeating the Philistines, killing a thousand of them with the jawbone of an ass, plus some other battles. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 14, we read about Samson's marriage to an unnamed Timnite woman, a woman from Timnah, right down the valley of Sorek, from Samson's home stomping grounds of Zorah and Eshtahol. And then in chapter 13, we saw Samson being born. We've still got some more of Samson in the next chapter, chapter 16, which of course is the famous story of Samson and Delilah. So now we start with Judges 15, verses 1 through 3. But after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife in her room. Now this wife is actually his ex-wife because he'd already caused a stink. If you recall, the ex-wife had revealed the answer to his famous riddle, out of the strong came something sweet, out of the lion came the honey. And so Samson, in order to pay off that riddle debt, he went out and killed 30 Philistines and took their clothes and paid off his debt. And so he had to go back home. That was the end of the wedding feast, the end of the marriage, really. But he didn't see it that way. He thought he was still married. But meanwhile, his ex-father-in-law had taken his wife, the Timnite woman, and given her to another man, actually one of Samson's attendants at the wedding. But Samson didn't really see his wife as being an ex-wife yet. So let's start over. Judges 15, 1 through 3. But after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a young goat and said, I will go into my wife in her room. But her father did not let him enter. Her father said, I really thought that you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please let her be yours instead. Samson then said to them, this time I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. Samson was not a happy camper when he heard that his wife was gone. When he's getting ready to take a goat, have a big meal, go into her, and when he says, I will go into my wife in her room, I suspect that he meant more than go in there and have a nice meal. I looked at a lot of my commentators, and I guess it's from 19th century bashfulness that nobody said why he was going into the room, but I suspect I know why he was going in there. And then instead to find out that she was gone, or at least maybe she was physically there, but she is married to somebody else and she was practically gone, he's not happy. And so he's going to take some vengeance on the Philistines. Now, in verse 1, the time that Samson went back from Zorah and Eshtahol back to Timnah was in the time of the wheat harvest. That little detail is mentioned because it has something to do with what happens later. As the pulpit commentary says, the harvest, as appears from verse 5, had begun, some corn already being cut, some wheat already being cut, and in shocks, piles of cut wheat, the rest still standing and being ready to cut. And of course, they were extremely dry and inflammable, and that's going to have relevance for our story when Samson burns it all up with torches between foxes' tails. Now, Samson arriving with a young goat shows that he was getting ready to have elegant entertainment for his wife, because that was considered a big deal. Goats might not sound so much to us, but back then, giving a goat for a meal, that was considered high-class entertainment. So obviously, Samson's anger had subsided by now. Now, the father, when confronted with Samson, of course, his daughter, if she was still there, would be in the separate women's apartments. And so her father would therefore be able to intercept Samson. And he said, I really thought that you hated her, so I gave her away. Did he really think that? Well, here's some options as to his mindset. He was utterly sincere, says Adam Clark. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says he was utterly insincere. This is interesting speculations that are 100% diametrically opposite. So I don't guess it's really easy to know, but at any rate, he would not let Samson enter to see his wife. Now, Samson was very strong. He could have forced his way in, but I'm sure that would have caused such a social and family disaster. You don't force your way into the women's apartments, not in the ancient Near East. So, being frustrated, he went and took it out on the Philistines, who had nothing to do with this dispute. In my opinion, this is tribalism at its worst. You blame people that had nothing to do individually with a matter, and you take it out on them. Now, John Gill is going to justify Samson and all his vengeance through this chapter. He says the destruction of the wheat field was in Samson's role as a public judge, not as a private figure. I quite frankly find that hard to believe. I don't see any mention of Samson being a judge here. Look, he was just ticked off. Seems to me this is private vengeance. We already know Samson's a gambler. We're going to later see he's a John. He goes into prostitutes. We know he's a, and now we see that he takes vengeance on people. He's got a temper, in other words. He's not exactly what you would call prime moral material for being a judge. Now the father, trying to cool Samson off, said, "Look here, Samson, I got another daughter you might want to look at. She's more beautiful than the one you lost." Well, if Samson had married that second daughter, he would have violated the law. Leviticus 18:18 says this, "You shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive, to uncover her nakedness." And so the argument goes, Samson was not attentive to the law because he was willing to marry two sisters. Well, there's a problem with that argument. First of all, you could make an argument that this law, Leviticus 18:18, does not really apply to Samson because he was divorced from his ex-wife, at least arguably so, the father having given her to Samson's companion to marry. So then he would only be married to one sister. However, you could read Leviticus 18:18 as applying even after a divorce, so you should never marry two sisters, no matter what your marital status was in the present or in the past. So that's arguable. Well, let's look at some options as to why did Samson refuse that younger sister. Well, John Gill says that Samson was so worried about Leviticus 18:18 that he didn't want to commit incest. Here's what Gill says. This allegation was a mere sham. The allegation Gill is talking about is, hey, I got a younger daughter that's beautiful, you can marry her. Gill says that's a sham, a flimsy pretext to excuse his refusal of admittance. The proposal he made of a marriage with her younger sister was but an insult to Samson, and which it was unlawful for an Israelite to accept. Well, maybe it was unlawful, and again, I say that's debatable, but I don't think Samson cared one whit about the law. I mean, the next chapter he's going to be going to see a prostitute at Gaza. Samson was not a man of high moral character. I don't think he cared about that. The reason he didn't accept the offer of marrying the younger sister is because he still loved his first wife, I think. I mean, after all, he's been gone for, what, roughly a year, maybe a long time, and he comes back and he's forgiven the first wife because she betrayed the answer to his riddle and caused him to have a big uproar, big fight with the Philistines. He didn't seem to care. He brought a goat back to her. He must have still yet loved this woman. And besides, that younger daughter might not have been more beautiful. She might have just been more beautiful in the eyes of her father, who's trying his best to get Samson out of his house before he gets his head beat in. So I wonder how objective he was about that more beautiful younger daughter. At any rate, Samson is ticked off. He's lost his woman of Timnah that looked so good to him. And so we now go to Judges 15:4-6. So he, Samson, went out and caught 300 foxes. He took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. Then he ignited the torches and released the foxes into the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the piles of grain and the standing grain as well as the vineyards and olive groves. Then the Philistines asked, "Who did this?" They were told it was Samson, the Timnite's son-in-law, because he has taken Samson's wife and given her to another man. So the Philistines went to her and her father and burned them to death. Well, let's take this issue of 300 foxes that Samson caught. Some skeptics think that it's not possible for Samson to catch 300 foxes. Well, it doesn't say how long Samson took to catch them. It might have taken him a while, but, I mean, if he spent 300 days, that's a fox a day. Or he could have had other people helping him catch the foxes, so that's a stupid objection, should a skeptic choose to make such an objection. There were lots of vineyards, as we'll see right here in verse 5, lots of vineyards around, and foxes like to hide in vineyards, as John Gill said, so easy to get the foxes. Now Samson took torches, and these torches were, of course, sticks of wood soaked in oily and resinous matter that came from trees, probably, I guess. I don't know where they got their asphalt from, their oil from. Those torches burn forever. They just go on and on and on, burning. He turned the foxes tail to tail and tied the torch in between each pair of tails, and then released them into the standing grain and the piles of grain. The piles of grain is a shock. A shock of grain, as the NASB translates it. So the harvest had begun but wasn't complete, and Samson ruined it. He probably released them at different places in the wheat fields there at Timnah for maximum effect, so the wheat would burn up quicker. And notice it wasn't only the wheat. It was the grain as well as the vineyards and olive groves. Vineyards for grapes and olive groves for olives. Foxes naturally would probably run to the vineyards for protection, burn the grapes up. Or maybe to the olive groves, burn them up. I mean, he burnt everything up. The foxes are naturally afraid of fire, so they're going to run hither and thither. Now, at this point, we need to mention some skeptics who say, well, now, it would have been easier just to tie one torch to one tail. Why would he tie a torch to two tails? Well, here's the answer to that from Matthew Poole. Quote, that the foxes might not make too much haste. They were tied tail to tail, so that the foxes might not make too much haste nor run into their holes, but one of them might delay and stop another in his course, and so continue longer in the places where they were to do execution. So this was real smart on Samson's part. One fox would just hightail it through the wheat, headed for safety, and wouldn't do as much damage, but two foxes pulling against each other are going to take longer to get out of the wheat fields and therefore do more damage with their fire. Now, some people who think that it's not possible for 300 foxes or 150 pairs of foxes to burn up the wheat fields, they say that foxes should be translated as shocks, i.e. shocks of wheat, piles of wheat. Now, Adam Clark has quotes another conservative scholar named Kennicott in his day, and I'll quote Kennicott, quote, to obviate these difficulties, and I don't think it's a difficulty, but to obviate the difficulties of how 150 foxes could burn up all that grain, it has been well remarked that the word shualim, here translated foxes, signifies also handfuls. Handfuls of barley, if we leave out that one-letter vowel, which has been inserted or omitted elsewhere, almost at pleasure. No less than 7 Hebrew manuscripts want that letter here and read shealim instead of shualim. Admitting, and please forgive my pronunciation, I don't know Hebrew. Admitting this version, we see that Samson took 300 handfuls or sheaves of corn, that means wheat, and sheaves means a shock, and 150 firebrands, that he turned the sheaves end to end and put a firebrand between the two ends in the midst, and then, setting the brands on fire, sent the fire into the standing corn of the Philistines. The same word is now used twice in one chapter, in the former verse signifying foxes, and the latter handfuls. Well, okay. So, linguistically, I guess that's possible, but it ruins such a good story. Let's just keep it with foxes. Now in verse 6, in response to their wheat fields and their vineyards and their olive groves getting burnt up, the men of Timnah go to, the Philistines of Timnah go to the woman and her father and burn them to death. You don't mess with these Philistines. Those are some nasty people. Now this was a severe punishment because the Timnite woman and her father had not done anything to their Philistine brethren to get the Philistine brethren so upset with them that they would burn up the daughter and father-in-law, Samson's daughter. Or Samson's ex-wife and Samson's ex-father-in-law. Why would they do that? Well, I guess what they're thinking is, look, if it hadn't been for that woman, marrying Samson, we wouldn't have had 30 Ashkelonites, 30 Philistines killed so that Samson could get their linen clothes. And now we wouldn't have had all of our crops burn up. If that woman had just stayed away from Samson, so we're going to take it out on them, we're going to punish them for it. Now, John Gill tries to mitigate the Philistines' offense of burning Samson's ex-wife and ex-father-in-law. Because Gil says, look, the ex-wife betrayed Samson and then committed adultery, so she got what she deserved. That's not why the Philistines killed the woman. They're mad because they lost their crops. They're not worried about whether she betrayed Samson and committed adultery. Besides, had she really committed adultery? Her father had given her to another husband. How's that adultery? She was in the laws of that time. I assume she's divorced. But at any rate, the wife ultimately suffered very grievously for betraying her husband. Remember in the previous chapter? Chapter 14, Samson had that nice riddle at the wedding feast that he was going to win because he was going to bet that the Philistine members of the feast would not be able to solve it, and he was going to make a ton of money with all that linen he was going to get. And doggone it, she betrayed him and told her Philistine buddies what the answer to the riddle was. She betrayed her husband. So, lesson there is, don't betray your husband. The results could be bad. Judges 15:7-9, then Samson told them, because you did this, I swear that I won't rest until I have taken vengeance on you. He tore them limb from limb with a great slaughter, and he went down and stayed in the cave at the rock of Etam. The Philistines went up, camped in Judah, and raided Lehi. Samson told them, because you did this, did what? Burn up his ex-wife and his ex-father-in-law. Now Samson's really ticked off now. He was ticked off at the father-in-law, but now the father-in-law's dead. Now he's ticked off at the Philistines for killing his wife. So he's going to take vengeance again. He's a man of vengeance. This is not just. John Gill says it's justice. He says that Samson is now acting publicly for Israel and not privately, so this is not private vengeance. I question that mightily. I don't believe that for a minute. This is just private vengeance. So we now establish that, at least in my view, that Samson was a man who took private vengeance. He goes to see prostitutes. He gambles. Now, John Gill says that the burning up of the ex-wife and ex-father-in-law by the Philistines was done by the Philistines in order to appease Samson. The Philistines, thinking Samson would be angry with the ex-wife and ex-father-in-law for taking Samson's wife away, they figured Samson was ticked off at the father-in-law, and so we'll burn the father-in-law up, as well as the wife who betrayed Samson, and so Samson ought to be happy. Actually, if that was what they were thinking, it sure didn't work. It had the opposite effect. Samson's mad as heck now, and he's going after him. Actually, I don't think the Philistines were seeking to appease Samson, as Gil says. I think they were mad because their crops were torn up. So now in verse 8, Samson tears the Philistines from limb, tears them limb from limb with a great slaughter. It doesn't say how many he killed. Now, I've got to mention the King James translation here because it's somehow so famous it's gotten into the English language. The King James says Samson smote them hip and thigh. I just love that expression, smote them hip and thigh. What does that mean? One of my commentators says this is variously understood, but the general meaning seems plain. He appears to have had no kind of defensive weapon, therefore he was obliged to grapple with them and, according to the custom of wrestlers, trip up their feet and then bruise them to death. That's why he would bruise them on the hip and also on the thigh. Some translate heaps upon heaps. In other words, he smote them and made a pile after pile of dead bodies. Others translate he smote horsemen and footmen, whatever that means. Others, he wounded them from their legs to their thighs, different versions. So there's a lot of different translations. I just like this one, Holman Christian Study Bible. He tore them limb from limb. Jameson Fawcett Brown says whatever the original phrase meant, it was probably a proverbial expression for merciless slaughter. All right, so Samson, having taken his vengeance on the Philistines for burning down his ex-wife, he goes and stays in a cave at the Rock of Etam. Now, Etam, E-T-A-M, means eerie. Well, that's a eagle's nest high up on a rocky cliff. Let's read what Easton says about that. There are two different places. Number one, a village of the tribe of Simeon, into some cleft of a rock here, Samson retired after his slaughter of the Philistines. I just read about that. It was a natural stronghold. That's why Samson went there. He wanted to be safe from the pursuing Samsonites, who, of course, were not happy with the fact that he had just killed a bunch of them hip and thigh. Etam has been identified with Beit Atab, west of Bethlehem, near Zorah and Eshtaol. That's Samson's birth and burial places. On the crest of a rocky knoll under the village is a long tunnel, which may be the cleft in which Samson hid. So we'll just say Etam is near Samson's hometown. He retreated near his home stomping grounds. Now, this is a rabbit trail here, but Easton's also gives a definition of another Etam, which was a different city, a city of Judah, fortified by Rehoboam. It was near Bethlehem and Tekoa, and some distance apparently to the north of Samson's Etam. It seems to have been in a district called Nephtoah. Where were the sources of the water from which Solomon's gardens and pleasure grounds and pools, as well as Bethlehem and the temple, were supplied? Different Etam. At any rate, Solomon's in his cleft of the rock, taking it easy after whooping up on a bunch of Philistines. Well, the Philistines aren't going to take this lying down, and so they go down to Judah, which is right south of here. Eshtaol and Zorah and Eshtaol and Etam are all in the tribe of Dan. Samson was a Danite, if you recall. Right south of Dan is Judah, and so the Philistines go down to Judah, coming up probably from up the valley of Sorek, the Sorek River. Go south a little bit, and they end up in a place called Lehi. Why would they do that? Why would the Philistines raid a Judean city, which was not involved in this dispute between them and Samson? My speculation is it was perhaps to put pressure on the men of Judah to find Samson and turn him over. They probably figured out. They probably had followed him. Somebody had told them that Samson was at the Rock of Etam, and they're trying to figure out how to flush him out. They say, okay, Etam is right. Even though it belonged to the tribe of Simeon, it was geographically within the borders of Judah, so we'll go put pressure on a Judean city, Lehi, and we'll get the Judeans to turn Samson over to us. Now, Lehi means a jawbone. Of course, he got his name after this famous battle here where Samson whooped him with the jawbone of an ass, killed 1,000. Here's what Easton says about Lehi. Quote, it means a jawbone, a place in the tribe of Judah where Samson achieved a victory over the Philistines, slaying 1,000 of them with the jawbone of an ass, which we're getting ready to come to right now. Judges 15, verses 10 through 11. The men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? And they said, we have come up to bind Samson in order to do to him as he did to us. Revenge, revenge. One act of revenge engenders another act of revenge, and it goes on and on like the Hatfields and McCoys. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us? And he said to them, as they did to me, so I have done to them. Samson didn't care if he got his fellow Israelites in trouble. He didn't care at all. He just wanted private vengeance. And the people of Judah were upset about it. They sent 3,000 men. That's a lot of soldiers. Why? Well, the people of Judah knew of Samson's great strength. Samson's holed up in a cave. He's hard to get to. They're going to overwhelm Samson with strength, which they did. The men of Judah are upset. They've been paying their tribute to the Philistines. They've been obediently submitting to them. They've been at peace with them, even though they had to pay tribute. And they were suddenly surprised to see the Philistines in their territory. What's going on here? We go now to Judges 15, verses 12 through 13. They, the men of Judah, said to Samson, we have come down to bind you so that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines. And Samson said to them, swear to me that you will not kill me. So they said to him, that's the men of Judah, said to Samson, no, but we will bind you fast and give you into their hands. Yet surely we will not kill you. Then they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock of Etam, the cleft there. Now they're going to give Samson into the Philistines, not because of any ill will they felt toward Samson. They were just trying to protect themselves. So they were having him safely bound for delivery. And of course, Samson gave up because he was outnumbered 3,000 to 1. So he figured, I've got no choice. He says, so please don't kill me. They said, fine, we're going to tie you up so we can deliver the package. Samson chose to submit to the men of Judah rather than to get the people of Judah involved in a bloodbath. Because if he hadn't have submitted and remained holed up there in that rock where the men of Judah couldn't have gotten to him, well, then the Philistines most probably would have attacked Judah and there would have been a big mess. So Samson, to his credit, said, okay, I quit. I'm not going to take this any further. I quit. Now, the men of Judah used two new ropes to tie him up, not just one. They were afraid of Samson's strength, which, of course, was supernatural because of his long hair and his Nazarite vow and because of what God was doing for him. Adam Clark says they probably used one rope to tie his hands up and another rope to tie his legs up. And notice it's mentioned that there are new ropes because new ropes are stronger than old ropes. We turn now to Judges chapter 15, verses 14 through 17. When he, that Samson, came to Lehi, in other words, from Etam, the cleft in the rock at Etam, down to Lehi, the Judean city. When Samson came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted as they met him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, upon Samson mightily, so that the ropes that were on his arm were as flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, so he reached out and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have killed 1,000 men. When he had finished speaking, he threw the jawbone from his hand, and he named that place Ramoth-Lehi. Now, why did the Philistines shout in verse 14 when Samson showed up at Lehi being escorted by the Judeans? They were shouting with joy. Hot dog, we've got this guy that's burnt up our crops. He's killed 30 of our men. Well, more than 30. He's smote us hip and thigh. He's torn us limb from limb. He's burnt up our grapes, burnt up our olives, burnt up our wheat, and we got him now. But right when they thought they had him, Samson burst his ropes and grabbed the fresh jawbone of a donkey or an ass that was there. Probably just took it because it was the first thing that he saw. And I believe it was providentially placed there by God, but so Samson would have something to fight with. Now, the scripture just very briefly says he killed 1,000 men with it. Now, this is interesting because a lot of people say, now, wait a minute. How can Samson kill 1,000 men? The most men ever killed by any one person was here, 1,000 men, and one of David's men killed 300. 1 Chronicles 11:11, one of David's mighty men, Jashobeam, lifted up his spear against 300, whom he killed at one time. And then Shamgar, the judge in chapter 3, killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. But that's not necessarily at one time. Here, Samson is killing 1,000 people at one time. So this is a big deal. And of course, the skeptics love to say, well, how could that happen? So now we'll look at the problem of how could one man kill 1,000 people. Now to answer this, I am heavily indebted to an Answers in Genesis article, which was excellent. I got most of these arguments from that article. Well, let's look at the factors that were involved in the killing of the 1,000 people. And when I finish with this, you will see this is not so improbable as you think. This is not a legend like it sounds like at first. First of all, the jawbone was probably from an onager, which is an Asiatic wild ass, and they're bigger than donkeys. Onagers weigh between 440 and 640 pounds, therefore the jawbone would have been a big one. Jawbone is said in the text, in the scriptural text, to be fresh. That means it would have more durability and elasticity than an old jawbone. That's the second factor. The third factor is the jawbone was not unwieldy. There's a natural handhold between the front teeth and the cheek teeth, therefore making it a formidable weapon. As I said earlier, Samson probably grabbed it as the first thing at hand when he was faced with the Philistines. Fourth factor, Samson's strength was supernatural. As we know, he had already broken the bonds of two ropes. Fifth factor, the Philistines were probably not prepared for Samson. They believed him to be tied up and defenseless. And oops, all of a sudden, there he is, standing there with the jawbone of an ass, and the Philistines are standing there with their jaws slack. Factor number six, Samson probably used his free hand balled up into a fist in addition to the jawbone. Factor number seven, Samson was probably in close quarters. The Philistine soldiers at the back probably rushed forward to see what was going on, and they also probably desired to deliver the death blow themselves. And in such a situation, they couldn't draw their swords, because if they drew their swords, they would either harm or kill the people in front of them. Or maybe they couldn't even draw the swords because they were packed so tightly. Eighth factor, the Philistines had to keep an eye on the 3,000 men of Judah who were there. And in fact, some of the Philistines may have turned to check on those 3,000 men just in time to get hit with a jawbone. Ninth factor, the Philistines were probably tired and exhausted. They had to march up from the Shephelah up to the Judean highlands. The Shephelah is the low coastal plain where the Philistines lived. And to get up to Lehi here in Judea was a long march, and they had to climb. Samson, on the other hand, was resting in the cleft of Etam when this confrontation took place. Factor number 10, Samson had the high ground. Ramoth Lehi, which was named later, that means hill of the jawbone. It was a hill. Samson was not flanked, probably. It doesn't look like he was flanked. The Philistines appear to have rushed him straight on in a blind rage. I think he could have done it. I am not surprised at all. Now, some scholars say that actually Samson didn't kill 1,000 Philistines. They're trying to protect the integrity of the scripture, and kudos to them for that, but I don't think that's proper or necessary, in my opinion. These scholars say that the Hebrew word for kill, nakah, can mean either kill or strike. So Samson is said to strike 1,000, but not necessarily kill all of them. Well, the first problem with that so-called strike instead of kill argument is that if Samson didn't kill most of the Philistines, what would prevent them from capturing him again? Makes it more likely that Samson could not have gotten away. But even stronger than that, I think, is verse 16. Sounds pretty dumb if the word strike is used as a translation for the Hebrew word that is usually translated kill. Judges 15:16 says this, "Then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey I have piled them in a heap. With the jawbone of a donkey I have struck 1,000 men." What's the big deal about striking 1,000 men if they don't get killed? Doesn't sound very noble and worth singing in a song about. So I'm going to assume that Samson did kill the 1,000. And here's another good argument against skeptics who think that Samson couldn't kill 1,000 men. How about this? Do skeptics doubt what happened at Thermopylae in the famous Persian War between the Greeks and the Persians? Are we to doubt that 300 Spartans plus about 7,000 mixed Greek forces held Thermopylae? They held it for two full days. They killed over 10,000 Persians, although they were outnumbered 10 to 1. Excuse me, they were outnumbered. I don't have the numbers down there. I think the numbers, of course, are exaggerated in the ancient sources, but I think a reasonable estimate is about 200,000, 300,000 Persians. The reason they got away, the Greeks got away with killing all those Persians, is because they were in a narrow defile where the Persians couldn't get through. They couldn't deploy all their forces on a broad front. At any rate, 10,000 Persians were killed by 1,000 Greeks for 2 days, and then once their position got compromised, Leonidas, the Spartan commander, dismissed all but his 300 Spartans and 700 Thespians, people from Thebes. That was 1,000, and by golly, those 1,000 Greeks killed another 10,000 Persians. Are we going to doubt that happened? Well, you know, if you want to be skeptical, your skepticism's got to stop somewhere. Now, when Samson went around in verse 16 saying, I have killed 1,000 Philistines, what was his attitude? Was he proud and haughty? I suspect he was. Some people say he was humble because he mentions the jawbone. He's giving the credit to God because only God could have used a jawbone to kill 1,000. I don't think so. I think the jawbone was just a tool, just a weapon. I think he was being proud of knocking off 1,000 Philistines. Again, I'm not very high on Samson's character here. Maybe I'm prejudiced a little bit. Now, after the killing of the 1,000 men, Samson threw his jawbone away, and he named that place Ramoth Lehi, which means Hill of the Jawbone, from which we know that Samson had the advantage of the terrain because he was up on that hill. NIV margin has Jawbone Hill. Adam Clark translates it as lifting up or casting away of the jawbone instead of a hill. It's the fact that he threw the jawbone away is where the name came from. If Clark's translation is right, that of course would ruin the argument that Samson had the high ground. At least it would not ruin it, but it would weaken it. Let's put it that way. We go now to Judges 15, verses 18 through 20, and we will finish chapter 15. Then Samson became very thirsty, and he called to the Lord and said, You have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? Now how about that? In his extremity, he prayed to God, so maybe he's not a bad guy, as bad as I've been making him out to be. Verse 19, But God split the hollow place that is in Lehi so that water came out of it. When he drank, his strength returned, and he revived. Therefore, he named it En Hakoreh, which is in Lehi to this day. So he, Samson, judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Now, verse 18, Samson became very thirsty, and that, of course, is natural. He just killed 1,000 Philistines. Big battle there. And apparently, he's on the run from the remaining Philistines that he didn't kill, because he can't just walk to a place to get some water. He's stuck somewhere where there's no water. Josephus thinks that he was thirsty because of God's punishment of him for ascribing the victory to himself and not God, and I think that's a stretch. I think he's thirsty just because he fought a battle. Samson was probably running from the Philistines that he hadn't killed. In other words, the leftovers from the 1,000, and so he was probably somewhere where water was not available. Now notice in verse 18 that Samson called to the Lord. He called to Yahweh. Samson, despite his character failing, still knew enough of Yahweh to call on his name. Now, I might say, though, that this might have been foxhole religion. He might have called on the Lord because he was in trouble, but in his daily life he didn't. But he did call on the name of Yahweh. And he's saying, look here, you gave me such a great victory, gave credit to God, and did not take credit for himself, because he says in verse 18, you have given this great deliverance. True, it was done by the hand of your servant Samson, but he ultimately gives credit to God. You have given this great deliverance. And then he says, am I going to fall into the hands of the uncircumcised, meaning the Philistines? It would be such a great shame after such a great victory that you have gotten that it all goes to waste if I get caught by these guys. And as again I said, as Answers in Genesis article says, and I think it's true, Samson no doubt had not killed every Philistine soldier. They were the ones chasing him at this point. Verse 19, God split the hollow place that is in Lehi so that water came out, and so Samson got some water. Now, the interesting thing about this is the King James translation says that it was the hollow place in the jawbone of the ass that water came from, which to me is laughable, a horrible translation, and yet I found one commentator that said, well, that could have been done, just a miracle. Oh, that's ridiculous. Most of the modern translations, I bet you every last one of them, has it translated water came out of the hollow place in the rock that God split. So an underground spring fed Samson. Samson named that place En Hakoreh, which, as the NIV margin says, means caller's spring, or as Matthew Poole translates it, the fountain of him that cried for thirst. Now, verse 20 says, So he judged Israel 20, Samson judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. So from the exciting beginning of his judgeship, the last several chapters we've talked all about his marital problems and his problems with the Philistines. After that, he's an official judge, and he fought the Philistines the whole time. Now, he didn't wipe them out. This is what Gill says, quote, While they had the power over the Israelites, he's talking about the Philistines, who were not entirely delivered out of their hands by Samson, he only began to deliver them, but did not completely do it. Though he got many advantages over them and wrought many salvations and deliverances, yet was not the author of perfect salvation. However, he was a check upon the Philistines and protected the Israelites from heavier oppressions, which otherwise they would have come under, and no doubt administered justice and judgment among them, and was an instrument of their reformation and of preserving them from idolatry. Now, this fulfills what the angel of Jehovah had told Manoah and Manoah's wife, the parents of Samson, in Judges 13:5, "For behold, you shall conceive," meaning the wife of Manoah shall conceive and give birth to a son, "and no razor shall come upon his head. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines." The Philistines weren't wiped out. I think David finally knocked them completely out. And ladies and gentlemen, that finishes us with chapter 15. Finally, we get to the next chapter, chapter 16, when Samson meets Delilah, of whom several movies have been made. The story is very famous. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.